harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the right beside me. The guy who claims he just don't believe me, right? And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the right side of me. Yeah, walking down with life, I'm fighting in a hard dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, I'm walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program. Here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Now, here's an interesting article by Father Raymond D'Souza, and it's about Canada's troubled relationships with Communist China. Will we grovel to China, asks Father D'Souza. Brian Mulroney wants Justin Trudeau to send, that's former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, to China to ask nicely for the release of Canadians being held on trumped-up espionage charges and for others that it has put on death row. These are two drug pushers that previously got 15 years and now suddenly they'd be retried and sentenced to death. This is to blackmail Canada. The arbitrary arrests and sentences are in apparent retaliation for Canada's arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou on an extradition request from the United States. The suggestion is that Chrétien, accompanied by his son-in-law André Desmarais, who's the chief executive officer of Power Corp, can use their high-powered Chinese contacts to spring the Canadians as a sort of favor from China's tyrants to their longtime Canadian friends. You notice the corporate collusion with Red China. And, of course, the strong ties to the political process. Aside from it being almost the definition of superfluous for anyone to send Chrétien, who made six trips to China's prime minister, and his continued visiting during his post-premiership, it is a bit peculiar that Mulroney, who is of course a conservative, Chrétien was a liberal, that Mulroney would publicly advise between China as one does North Korea or Saddam's Iraq. Bill Clinton headed to North Korea in 2009 to secure the release of imprisoned journalists. It's the kind of thing one does when dealing with a totalitarian regime in which there is no rule of law, but just the decrees of the powerful. Ritual obeisance is made, and the tyrant shows how magnanimous he is by granting a pardon. In 1990, when Saddam Hussein was holding 15 Americans hostage as human shields after his invasion of Kuwait, Muhammad Ali dispatched himself to Baghdad. Saddam kept the champ cooling his heels before benevolently granting him an audience. Saddam got what he wanted, the greatest of all time coming cap in hand, contrary to the wishes of the administration, and sent the Americans home with Ali. So it can work with certain regimes, and it's more than a passing interest that Mulroney thinks the Chinese are not a respectable regime capable of impartial justice, but need the Saddam treatment, and that a little bowing and scraping will get the job done. Bowing before Peking is something Mulroney himself is rather good at, although, as his proposal acknowledges, Gretchen is the master. During the Oliphant inquiry into his business practices, Mulroney himself reported that he was in China within months of his retirement as Prime Minister, along with Paul Desmarais, Senior, Andre Desmarais, and Maurice Strong. Maurice Strong was an arch conspirator and a big promoter of global warming, and just an all right bad guy. And it was at that time with Ontario Hydro, and he was an old Power Corp. Hand. Power Corp is owned by this Quebec multi-billionaire Paul Desmarais, who has close ties with Red China. Mulroney claimed that he lobbied the Chinese to buy military equipment from the German manufacturer Thyssen. At the time, Canada still had arms trading sanctions against China, imposed by Mulroney himself after the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989. But no need to let that get in the way of doing a little business. About a year later, in November 1994, Chrétien went to China with his first Team Canada trade mission to announce, in effect, that the Chinese would buy enough of our goods. Sorry, that if the Chinese would buy enough of our goods, the unpleasantness of Tiananmen would be forgotten. And so it was. The Chinese were mightily pleased, and what followed was the so-called golden decade of Sino-Canadian relations. Mulroney and Chrétien and any number of former worthies continue to travel back and forth to China, a veritable bipartisan parade that is always at the ready to explain how Chinese sensitivities must be taken into account when speaking, if absolutely necessary, about one of the world's greatest humanitarian human rights abusers. The usual line is that everything goes much better if one is discreet about the nastier elements of the Chinese Communist Party's stranglehold on civic life. Yeah, so it always goes better if you don't say anything. Well, Rudy Chrétien and Desmarais have delivered that line 1,000 times, but the government can hardly adopt that line when the Chinese are threatening to execute two of our citizens. The government has condemned in no uncertain terms the arbitrary treatment of the Canadians and protests of the various trade penalties that the Chinese have taken against Canadian agricultural exports. What then does Mulroney imagine Chrétien and Desmarais can say to the Chinese? Would they suggest that the Canadian government doesn't really mean what it says, or apologize quietly for arresting the Mrs. Meng? Or would they promise some other secret concessions for the release of the Canadians? Chrétien, without even having yet been formally asked to help, is already suggesting that Canada's justice minister should simply cancel the extradition process and give into Peking's demands by allowing Meng to return to China, according to the Globe and Mail report just recently. The Chrétien and Mulroney Desmarais China operation is institutionalized by the Canada-China Business Council, founded by the late Paul Desmarais Sr. The current chairman of the board of directors is Olivier Desmarais. They will hold their annual Canada Day in Peking Gala next week. the principal sponsors being the Federal Tourism Crown Corporation, Destination Canada, and, wait for it, Power Corp, along with the Royal Bank of Canada, Bank of Montreal, and Manulife. Toast will be given, lobster will be served, and the message will be received in Peking that Canada is desperate to get back to business as usual by pretending that it is business as usual. Is that the message the Canadian government wants to send? Doubtful, but if so, it's not necessary to send Chrétien and Desmarais. That message is being delivered by Power Corporation in China for generations. So, you know, there is part of this, I thought, very detailed, very shrewd write-up by Father D'Souza. Well, here's a report by my good friend, citizen journalist Brad Love. He's the voice of the working man. He's in Fort McMurray, Alberta, in the oil sands. And he writes, and this is dated June 14th, 2 days ago I attended a 6 p.m. Have You Ever Experienced Religious Bias meeting held at our downtown Unifor headquarters. Now, Unifor is a big trade union. It's the old United Auto Workers and then some. There were 25 folk, mostly Muslims, sitting at five tables with food platters and drinks available. The mayor, Don Scott, the mayor, Don Scott, opened things by proclaiming he had experienced racism. Really? Although he offered no explanation, nor did he stay long. Two younger male and female RCMP police sat at separate tables to chat up anyone who wandered by. Various female Muslims, all dressed appropriately, blathered on about hatred, uncomfortable looks, and perhaps as passing UFO that had bothered them at some point in time. I felt as if I were in the middle of a Saturday Night Live skit. I kid you not. After 30 minutes of being the token white male in the room, I reloaded my plate with cold cuts and salad and then split. Enough is enough, right? How did these Muslims convince the union, Unifor, to hold the event or the cops and mayor to attend? The power of a small group who stick together is evident, though most in town and never witnessed this. Too bad. Three blocks away in their rundown, shabby rundown, shabby-looking mosque, where oddly Brian Jean lives three doors down from. Brian Jean is a former member of Parliament. Cars parked haphazardly constantly jam up this small residential neighborhood. Gene knows he helped create this mess, or does he even get it? He was the former leader of the Wild Rose Party. I can't imagine that many Muslims belong in that union that represents hundreds of sin-crude workers, as Muslim males shy away from dirty labor, preferring taxi or storekeeper jobs. Meanwhile, their women stay home and create more and more kids for our hospitals and schools to cope with. And no one says a thing. In a perfect world, new Canadians would work for a few years to contribute to the country's tax base before overloading the system with their costly medical problems and pregnancies. But alas, these greedy humps don't think of that. Months back, our local hospital proclaimed that they are serving more halal meals than ever, as if that's a good thing. Irresponsible Filipinos and young broken Indians also play this baby race game, with many Indian kids going straight into government care due to their fucked up parents. Again, not due to, again, not many recognize this fraud and robbery of our resources that we paid for. Oh, in Canada, we reward uninvited and unwanted tripe who have given us nothing, and yet it's our very old people who piss away our money on people who have absolutely no business in being here. That's all. That's Brad Love, citizen journalist. Oh, I love the way he, you know, he gets right to the point.
This is one that really makes me angry.
It appears that there's going to be an appeal of a decision by a lower court judge in Ontario to give what is going to be soon called the black discount. And this is a perfect example of the fact that, you know, if you believe in nonsense, you do nonsensical things. You know, for instance, if you truly believe the earth is flat, and I hope I'm not offending anybody when I say I do not believe the earth is flat, but if you believe the earth is flat, you would be terrified to sail any great distance toward the horizon for fear that, you know, you'd fall off the edge of the earth, right? What was set to be a simple appeal of a sentence for possession of a loaded handgun has burgeoned into a major push for judges to acutely focus on systemic racism against visible minorities when passing sentence, similar to special rules in place for Indian or Aboriginal offenders. Now, get this. Already, if an Indian commits a crime, he has to be given special consideration at sentencing. I'm sorry, if he's convicted of a crime. If he's committed, if he's merely charged and not convicted, it doesn't matter. But if he's convicted of a crime, the judge must give special consideration in sentencing to the colonialism and racism and systemic problems that he allegedly suffered. Now, this is absolutely a crock. Colonialism. Well, you know, we haven't been a British colony for since 1865. There's no Indian around today who was ever colonialism, racism. But you know, that's a very easy accusation. Everything's racist. But was it? Was it in fact racism? And has this Indian been the victim of racism? And even if at some point somebody said something nasty to him because he's an Indian, does that give him an excuse to not commit crime? The alibi for these people is just insane, and you know, it goes back to a mistaken belief. And here's the belief. The belief is all people are equal, which means results must be equal. Well, if they're not equal, then what? Well, it must be because of something. Well, let's say it's because of racism. You see, the original premise is wrong. All people are not equal, as in the same. And therefore, the results are going to be different. You see, what really sticks in the craw, and I'll get to the blacks in a minute, but what really sticks in the craw of Canada's cultural Marxists is the indisputable fact that there are the Native Indians are disproportionately represented in the prisons. They represent 4% of the population, and some areas are 25% of the prison population. Well, you know, if all people are equal, how can that be? You know, how can that be? If all people are equal, the people would be equally represented in prison. Well, you see the problem, of course. Well, because all people are not equal. And Indians, even in our permissive system, which bends over backwards for minorities, the Indians are disproportionately represented in the prison system because, come on, this is not a tough question, because they disproportionately commit crimes sufficiently serious and usually violent to merit going to be sent to jail. And that's the answer. But of course, that would then suggest all people are not equal, which is very hard for the cultural Marxists to accept. So rather than say, gee, our original premise might be wrong, maybe people are not all equal, or equal in the sense that results ought to be equal. You know, if you posit equality in the sense of God loves everybody equally or something like that, that's theological. But and I'd say essentially it's unknowable. But anyway, if you believe erroneously all people are equal, then you can assume the results are equal. Well, then when results are not equal, rather than say, gee, maybe our original premise was wrong, you go in search of a simple explanation, and that's racism. So, okay, so back to the blacks. 11 prominent human rights, legal, and ethnic organizations have been granted special status in the government's appeal of a lenient sentence of a Toronto Negro last year. Quote, as a general rule, a technical legal matter. Anyway, the Ontario Chief Justice George Strathie allowed these interveners. He said, but the issues that arise in this appeal transcend the interests of the parties and are of significance to the administration of criminal justice. The proposed interveners are well-recognized organizations with experience and expertise in the issues raised in this appeal. They can offer perspectives that are different from those provided by the Crown and the respondent. The appeal stems from the sentencing of Kevin Morris, who was caught with a loaded handgun after fleeing police in 2014 to Toronto. Last September, after the jury found him guilty, Ontario Superior Court Justice Sean Nakatsuru specifically gave Morris, then 26, a self-declared lenient sentence of 1 year to address one small step at a time the problem of the disproportionate incarceration of black offenders. You see what he's saying? And blacks are wildly disproportionately represented in Ontario prisons because, well, yeah, it could be because of racism. It could also be, and it of course is, because they disproportionately commit crime, usually violent crime, the sort of a crime that gets you a jail sentence. And the frightening thing is that the cultural Marxist ideology has so blinded many members of the judiciary that they truly are in a quandary. Why is it that blacks are so disproportionately represented in prison? Because they disproportionately commit crime. The color of crime, if by that we mean violent crime, in Toronto is black. Blacks constitute about 8% of the population of the city of Toronto. They are involved in about 75% of violent crime defined as rape, armed robbery, or murder. In my newly adopted town or city of Hamilton, blacks, I would think, are probably less than 1%. But of the 5 murders thus far this year, blacks were the victims and apparently the perpetrators in 4 of them. And in the 5th, the victim was a person connected with the Italian mob. But the hitman that they're looking for is black. So the color of crime in my city, or at least the color of violent crime, is black. Now, given that, what on God's green earth does racism have to do with it? Well, instead of accepting that some groups commit more crimes than others, the judge would apparently want to. He's a problem here. He gave Nakatsura, who would normally get about 4 years for that firearms offense, he gave him a lenient sentence of 1 year. And he said it was to address the problem of disproportionate incarceration of black offenders. Well, they're disproportionately incarcerated because they disproportionately commit violent crime. Nakatsura's lengthy sentencing decision was an impassioned declaration of the struggle to balance the public's outcry over gun violence with systemic racism against young black males. Where is the racism against young black males? This is never explained. Why does a young Negro go out and commit violent crime? How does racism have anything to do with it? You would almost suspect that some poor black was just walking on his way back from the library having studiously put in some time on his books, and a racist white policeman comes along and slaps the handcuffs on him and charges him with a crime he didn't commit, and a racist judge convicts him and sentences him to jail. But that's not the reality. The reality is that the black has committed a crime, and usually a violent crime. Now, rather than looking for at systemic racism, that is, the system is stacked against you, and it's almost unbelievable in such a liberal leftist society that secretly deep down, policemen, judges, crown attorneys, defense lawyers are all in cahoots to try to keep the blacks down. It defies imagination. But these ideologues are living in cloud cuckoo land. A search for the causes of black crime might be better spent looking at dysfunctional black families, where there's an 82% illegitimacy rate. Frequently, there is no permanent man on the scene. Lack of family cohesion, lack of a good male role model. Those may be the problem. And what does that have to do with racism? Nakatsura went on to say, I know that some may accuse me of being soft on crime, on gun crime. I do not believe that is so. Recognizing as the law must that individuals are held responsible for the acts they commit that breach the criminal law, the reality is that this choice to act may be constrained by an offender's life circumstances. What's he saying? The reality is that this choice, the choice to act, to commit a crime, can be constrained by a person's life circumstances. He goes on to add, there are systemic and case-specific factors that lessen your moral blameworthiness for this offense and soften the impact of general deterrence and denunciation. The Crown had sought a 4.5-year prison term for Morris and appealed the sentence. The Crown, however, did not object to the interveners. Now, this is truly extraordinary. He's suggesting that racism or discrimination against blacks somewhat reduced the choice that this fellow had, which led him to carry a loaded handgun when he fled from the police. Now, try to piece that out together. Now, what does it mean? Racism made him turn to a life of crime? How was that? Why didn't he work? Why didn't he get a job? White society wouldn't give him a chance? No. We've got employment equity. We have programs that bend over backwards for visible minorities. You know, the person who might, and I don't buy it as an excuse, but might
have a legitimate gripe would be a young white person who finds himself the victim of pro-minority discrimination.
We have a system that that discriminates against our own people. Blacks get special treatment.
Okay, continuing on here. Faisal Mirza, lawyer for Mr. Morris, said in an interview that he hopes the outcome of the appeal will fix an obvious flaw in the judicial system. All it means is giving the people who have to decide someone's fate the full information. It doesn't mean the person's not going to face stiff consequences. People are still going to be punished and separated if they do something violent. That's not going to change. But it's going to make our system better because it would mean that we are sentencing people on the right information. They're sentenced because they commit crime. Aboriginal and black people are disproportionately before the courts and in jails, courts have long noted. Well, why? Unless they are saying that they are falsely charged, but then falsely convicted, and then trucked off to jail. Is that what they're really saying? Well, that would mean basically saying that they themselves are hopelessly corrupt and racist. But that, of course, is not the case. They are trying desperately to square the circle here to somehow come up with an explanation other than the obvious as to why blacks disproportionately are before the courts, because they disproportionately commit crime. And they're disproportionately in jail because they are very frequently convicted. Much more so than, let's say, Chinese or whites. But this runs into a conflict with this almost religious ideology of equality. Ever since the Supreme Court of Canada decision called Regina versus Gladue, when sentencing Aboriginal offenders, judges across Canada must pay particular attention to individual circumstances as well as systemic or historical factors such as colonialism, residential schools, and systemic racism. Now, it's legitimate in sentencing to take into account personal factors. That is, tailoring the sentence to the reality of the individual. But we get into some really loosey-goosey territory when we start talking about historical factors such as colonialism. How would colonialism make a young Indian who, if he gets an education, will be given free university tuition courtesy of the Canadian taxpayer, unlike white youth? How does colonialism justify a person not taking the educational opportunities, let's say, and instead abusing substances, alcohol or other intoxicants, and turning to violence? Free will is an important factor. People in generations gone by came from poverty and difficult circumstances. The Irish, when they came to Canada and the United States initially, had come out of the terrible poverty, or actually the starvation, of the Great Potato Famine of 1846 to 1848. Many times, often when they came to North America, they were reviled. There were signs in some places saying, no Irish need apply, or no Irish not wanted. Most worked hard, overcame the circumstances, gained acceptance, and so on.
Would mere discrimination or unfairness have justified a life of crime? Absolutely not. Many people have experienced problems in their youth. An unloving parent, an alcoholic parent, situations like that. Sad as those may be, that's not an excuse to commit crime. It's not. And what the system is doing here is actually alibi for them. And that is a double injustice. It's an injustice to the victims of crime, lessening the culpability of the perpetrators. It's an injustice to the criminal, ironically, in that it's making an excuse for him and actually treating him as less than a responsible person. And it actually just encourages more of that group, whether it's Indians or in this case blacks, to commit crime by saying, well, you know, you're not really responsible for it. You know, the system made you do it. Christianity Under Attack. This is written by for the Daily Telegraph by Catherine Papenster. A dark time for Christians across the globe, and the West doesn't care. The death and destruction in Ceylon was particularly shocking, given that it took place on Easter Sunday, the holiest feast of the Christian year. However, it was horribly familiar, for we now are living through the unprecedented era of Christian persecution. Most people associate persecution of Christians with the Roman Empire and martyrs facing lions. Others may recall the Soviet regime and the repression of believers during the time of Stalin. But this century is fast becoming a rival to both those eras. According to the respected Pew Research Center, Christians are the most targeted body of believers in 144 countries, up from 128 in 2015, and there is barely a country from Saharan Africa to Pakistan where Christians worship freely without intimidation. The persecution takes various forms. The bloodshed of Sri Lanka was of a particular kind. It was well organized, with four churches bombed, as well as Western-style hotels, and well planned. A religious holiday was the date underlined in the bombers' calendar. Elsewhere, in such countries as Bosnia and Herzegovina, Christians are tolerated but suffer discrimination in such areas as employment, and in many countries there is state oppression by political regimes. The future of Christianity is particularly grim in North Africa and the Middle East, the very cradle of Christianity. In Egypt, the Copts, who belong to one of the most ancient Christian traditions, have been targeted over and over after centuries of living peacefully with their Muslim neighbors. In January in Libya, a mass grave was found containing 34 Ethiopian Christians killed by Islamic State fighters. The destruction of Christianity in Iraq after Islamist groups emerged in the wake of the war in 2003 has been so overwhelming that there are barely any Christians left in cities like Mosul. And of historical interest, and very ironically, Christians were protected by, that's right, the person that George Bush the First and Bush the Second overthrew and eventually had killed, Saddam Hussein. That's the problem with meddling. Yet it is further east in Asia where the persecution is at its worst, according to a report from the Open Doors organization earlier this year. As in the Middle East, the assailants are often members of other religions, such as Hindus in India and Muslims in Pakistan. Its form includes terrorist atrocities, but also grave harassment, such as in Pakistan, where Asia Bibi spent 8 years on death row for blasphemy. In China, the communist political regime is responsible for oppression akin to that within the old Soviet Union. The government attempts to monitor and control
the practice of religion through the state-sanctioned patriotic Catholic and patriotic Protestant churches. But most of the country's 100 million Christians belong to unregistered churches, which are regularly closed down and members detained in camps. The government in China continually insists that it will tolerate Christianity if it is not in conflict with socialism and undergoes sinicization, which means made Chinese, whatever that implies. In other words, it must be at its heart Chinese and not an import. Similar demands are made elsewhere too, with nationalists accusing Christianity of being alien in Bhutan, Burma, and Nepal. Others who oppose it claim that it is a religion of the West imposed by colonialists. The Sri Lanka bombers, by targeting Western-style luxury hotels and churches at the scene, appear to also want to convey this message. But inside those churches were ordinary Sri Lankans. Across the world, Christianity is being embraced by people of all races. The attacks in Sri Lanka come at a time when British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt is awaiting a review of the British government's response to Christian persecution. According to the Bishop of Truro, the Right Reverend Philip Mount Stephen, who's conducting the post-colonial guilt among Christianity has affected attitudes in the UK and lessened interest in its oppression. He has spoken of British diplomats abroad who have denied Christian persecution is happening in the countries of their posting, even when believers have been targeted. With attacks like those in Sri Lanka, greater attention might now be paid to the plight of Christians across the globe. Church leaders who welcomed Hunt's review will want to see if it leads to concrete change, such as a block on trade and aid to countries that tolerate the targeting of their Christian communities. And that's what's needed. The West has to read these countries the Riot Act. They're not going to be getting the goodies if they continue to persecute Christians. That, of course, is not what some of the politically correct and cultural Marxists want by any means. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Going to play a little bit of Hank Williams Jr. as I've been doing of late as my musical interlude. This is a lot. Some of his songs are quite biographical. And this one, All My Rowdy Friends, said about. He's talked about people in his circle, people like Chris Christopherson, Waylon Jennings, and so on. And I think that that's what makes this particularly charming. There is a real reality here. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. Shows repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time.